What was interesting to me was that in 2001, 2002, one of the jobs I had during my time in the joint staff was to deal with the things that nobody else wanted to deal with. And one of those was responding to snowflakes. That was the memos that came down from Rumsfeld, because Rumsfeld, one of the things he wanted to do was close down all the American commitments around the world and bring troops back home. And the first time I got this memo, it had all these different commitments. I coordinated with all the joint staff officers responsible for the Sinai desk, the East Timor desk, and so on. And when I sent that list back up, it came back down after it hit our two-star officer above me. And that was the only time I really saw service in my entire year in the joint staff, because it was an Air Force officer who wanted to get the U.S. Air Force commitment to Iceland and get it removed from the country. Because at that time, the United States had four, I guess it must have been F-15s, based in Iceland. And the Air Force wanted out, and I was like, why does the Air Force care about it? It's only four planes. You got plenty of fighters. And it turned out because they had four planes there, they also had to have long-range search and rescue helicopters and planes based there in case any of those planes dropped into the Atlantic. And those were scarce, and those were high, treasured commodities, particularly as Afghanistan started to heat up. And so this led to a tussle between the Air Force and the Navy, because the Navy had, as I knew from my Tom Clancy reading, important bases on Iceland for monitoring the sonar nets in the Atlantic. And so Iceland was saying, if you remove NATO's commitment to defending Iceland, we're going to kick out the Navy. So that was the one time I saw, the services compete with each other in my year in the joint staff because of the issues I was dealing with. And, at the time I was thinking about Tom Clancy, and every time Iceland comes up, I think about Tom Clancy because of Red Storm Rising.
Right. I mean, there's almost nothing to prevent the Soviets from invading Iceland with a barge, secretly, and then basing Tu-22s off of it, if there are no F-15s there.
That's right. Well, exactly. I mean, the whole book was a silly scenario, but it was kind of fun.
Right.
But one of the problems of that book were also evidence late it came in much later evidence in the subsequent Jack Ryan books, which was there was an initial political scenario which kicked off the war, and the problem was that Tom Clancy was great on the technology of war and of doctrine and modeling those kinds of things. And he was really lousy, not just right-wing lousy. I'm not saying it was bad because he was right-wing. I'm saying it was bad because he was completely unrealistic.
Right.
You can be right-wing and not be unrealistic about how politics worked. And so I really was found his earlier books compelling and interesting scenarios. The defection of a Soviet submarine, Red Storm, Red October, Hunt for Red October, was a great book. It was really engaging. And then Red Storm Rising, a vision of what World War III looked like, was really engaging. The origins of Jack Ryan as getting involved in terrorism, good old fashioned Irish terrorism.
Right.
Those were really good yarns and really engaging. It was when the books became more about politics. The Japanese airline pilot that first of all, having Japan involved in a war like that was just stupid. But
Right.
but
A
having
complete
having the suicide
misunderstanding
bomber.
of Japanese revol- a complete misunderstanding of Japanese right-wing attitudes,
Yeah.
right? And I mean, well, actually, one and this is probably, I mean, this is this is the pre-Debt of Honor, but people don't talk about this a lot. But I mean, Cardinal of the Kremlin is not so much a techno thriller; it's just sort of a genuinely good spy yarn, right? There are these fantastic scenes of torture in a sensory deprivation tank, right? It's torture, but it's not torture, but it's scary, right? It's genuinely scary. I mean, and Clancy puts those together in a way that don't necessarily accord with his reputation as a prose stylist, right? I mean I mean he's able to put together sort of really interesting scenes of just horror, of being in just this terrible situation. But then he'll also write sex scenes, and they're the worst ever, right? And he'll write scenes, and they're the
Yeah,
worst
well, I
ever.
was a teenager at the time, so I wasn't really a connoisseur of sex scenes. Those never really stuck out to me, so I guess that probably shows his weakness, because if as a teenager I would have paid more attention to his sex scenes if they were any good.
Right. I mean, what I've been told by people in uniform military, and this is an interesting argument too, and I didn't really pick up on it having first read Hunt for Red October when it came out in paperback way back when, is that a lot of people treat the Clancy's early books as sort of you know, a literary break from post-Vietnam military fiction. Post-Vietnam military fiction in which, you know, the army especially is depicted in a certain way with respect to drug use and incompetence and everything else. And that Tom Clancy sort of provides that very, a very clear break where almost everyone who's in uniform in a Tom Clancy novel is intelligent, is honorable, is professional in a way that, and this really lets sort of his right wing issues come out too, in a way that the civilians almost never are, right? Among almost all the presidents, almost all the politicians are terrible and they're terrible on both sides, whether they're Soviet or whatever. They're almost always terrible. But the
and all the army guys are honorable, whether they're their enemies or, you know, the adversaries always have a, you know, it's sort of like the World War II thing where there's the good Nazi and then the bad Nazi, and there's a lot of that in Clancy's work.
Right, right, exactly.
The good Wehrmacht, yeah, versus the bad Nazi, yeah.
Right, 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 and, you know, a lot of respect for Red Army in general, and, you know, even in Red Storm Rising, Red Navy captains and Marco Ramius and so forth, so, and it's, you know, it's sort of fascinating in context of that kind of political shift in how people view the military, you know, sort of post-1980s. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's also, I think that there may also be some interesting insights in terms of sort of the growing, you know, that Tom Clancy provides, I think, for a lot of people, an introduction to a lot of basic military terminology, too. Like, I mean, and I mean, not just anybody, but like real people who grow up to be sort of genuine academics and analysts, right? Tom Clancy is sort of not a bad introduction into this is what submarines actually do, right? This is what certain kinds of aircraft do. This is
what a crazy eyes and and the thing is I came at it from I wouldn't have seen it, but that the way you put it makes sense to me, because you know the two kinds of books that I was reading in sort of high school on my fun time were World War II submarine books, mostly about the American War in the Pacific. Mm-hmm. So there was sort of a natural moving from all those books about, you know, depicting that submarine war to then finding Clancy with Red Storm with Red October, and actually submarines played a role in Red Storm Rising as well.
Right.
So that was a natural bridge. But I was reading a fair amount of the Vietnam stuff as well, but I was too young to realize what a shift that Clancy was making from the very dark and very flawed and tragic wars that the United States was fighting, you know, towards the end of the Cold War. Mm-hmm. Versus this nice and shiny, heroic American military that, you know, emerged, you know, in the Reagan era as being, you know, the most respected institution. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is a legacy of that, you know, of Vietnam, but it's also sort of the Reaganization or maybe even the Clancyization of the military, which is that whole line about we got to respect our troops because our troops are so honorable. You know, what we've seen in Afghanistan and Iraq is, you know, a lot of our troops were pretty damn honorable, but we also had people, you know, Marines pissing on corpses, and we had, you know, the kill squad, and so, you know, there is a downside to the Clancyization of the military, which is, you know, we got to respect these guys who did fight, but we also got to hold the units accountable when they did things wrong.
Right.
I snarked a couple, I guess a week or two ago, about the new Medal of Honor winner,
mm-hmm.
which was
Captain Swenson?
Yeah, Captain Swenson.
Yeah.
Is that we tend to have lots of Medal of Honor winners when they have lousy commanders. And the good news is we don't really have that many Medal of Honor winners, so maybe we don't have as many bad commanders, because the basic premise was this. You know, you get these kinds of heroes when they're outgunned and outnumbered. And put in positions where we're really at a disadvantage. That's when you get these records of heroism. We have heroes all the time, but the ones who get the biggest awards, the most noted awards, are ones who are in the most tragic of circumstances.
Right.
The Mogadishus, Black Hawk Down, or the villages, you know, the towns in eastern Afghanistan, where afterwards you go, what were the commanders thinking putting these people in this circumstance?
Right.
And I was trying to figure out whether this is good news or bad news that we had these, you know, spate of award winners, both the Black Hawk Down guys, the two Delta soldiers who got killed, or the two more recent Medal of Honor winners, Swenson and Dakota Mayer. And in some ways, you can look at this as a positive, because we haven't had that many of them, which means that American military leadership hasn't been that incompetent.
Right. No, I mean, to boil that down into something that I, you know, actually I may use in class, right, is that part of the point of good, you know, even at the sort of good tactics and good operational design is to reduce the need for heroes, right? I mean, I never quite thought about it in that way, but it makes a lot of sense, right? I mean, just to reduce the situations in which you need truly heroic behavior in order to accomplish an objective, to accomplish a goal, right? And you'll always need some, because there's always friction, right? There's always sort of things that happen that are unexpected, the enemy always gets a vote, and so forth, but that sort of good tactical planning and good organizational design or operational design removes that as much as possible.
And that's one of the things where, if we want to circle around back to caveats again, is, you know, there are countries that said, you know, like the Germany used to have rules that said that if somebody is, if you're shooting at somebody and they stop shooting at you and they shift position, you got to stop shooting at them. Even if that person is not retreating, but just moving to a different place to fire at you better.
Right.
And that's exactly the opposite of what any military wants, is the military wants to be able to fire at someone when they can't fire back at you.
Right.
And that seems unfair and unkind, but that's the nature of war, is to be in a, you want to be behind somebody's head and having a gun to their head rather than being in front of them. Just, you know, your favorite topic of air warfare. You want to be behind somebody shooting at them so they can't shoot back at you.
Right.
And whether it's caveats or poor leadership, and sometimes there's a bit of both going on, that takes away the edge for the military to do what they should be doing.
Right.
If you put them in harm's way.
Right, right. Well, that makes a lot of sense. All right, well, I think actually on that, having been able to bring the conversation together, right, I think we should end on that point rather than sort of stringing it out, because that almost puts it into a perfect circle, right? We get brings us back to from Clancy all the way back to caveats and NATO. So
well, it's all about promoting my book.
Exactly, right? Which hopefully will sell, you know, maybe, I don't know, would you be satisfied with half the copies of Hunt for Red October, or do you need 2/3?
I would be very satisfied with some percentage of Hunt for Red October. The good news is that the book is going to be priced competitively with whatever Red Storm Rising came out with, or Hunt for Red October. So they're just about the same kind of book. Mine's could be thinner.
All right. Okay, well, Steve, thanks for joining me today. This has been fantastic, and hopefully we'll do so some point soon in the future.
My pleasure.
Bye.